Welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast, episode 127.
Greetings and welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas, and today I have a returning guest and someone I've been wanting to have back on for quite a while, and he's back to talk about, you know, some really cool new books he's been doing and hopefully not be too angry with me on my experience with some of his recommendations from before. But regardless of all that, I'm very pleased to have back on the show Scott Brian Wilson. Scott, thank you so much for coming back on.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
So, like I said before, you know, you're back on the show. You know, last time we were talking about True Cult and all that, but you've had, you know, some other stuff come out. You got some cool stuff happening with, you know, your book Killmore, and you sent me some one shots that you did, especially one called 3 Days to Death is Here, which I really, really dug. I thought that was a really cool one shot, and, you know, all the kinds of cool stuff going on. So, but before we get into that, you know, we got to do the show title, Comics Coffee Metal. What are you digging right now?
This is an old fashioned. That's what I'm digging right now.
A nice old fashioned. If I recall correctly, you weren't too much into coffee, but you were talking last time.
Yeah,
you,
like
we were talking about, you know, we're reminiscing about soda, and you brought up a soda called Zevia, which, you know, yeah. I went to go try, and that's where I really learned that the stevia sweetener and I are not compatible at all.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, I'm not compatible with it either, because I ended up in the hospital with a kidney stone.
Oh boy!
And it turned out it was the stevia, the just ungodly amount of it I had been drinking.
Yeah,
made a little stone. So me and Zevia said goodbye after that. And I just went back to Diet Dr. Pepper. So, yeah. You know.
Well, I'm sorry that your experience ended up being a lot worse than mine. Mine doesn't seem so funny anymore.
And Diet Dr. Pepper's fucking cheaper than Zevia anyway, so it's all good.
Yeah. Well, I went and I tried it, and I had high hopes because, you know, I'm like, you know, let me go try this. I'm always down to try something. And first and foremost, the taste of it, I was just like, oh, man, this is not good. And I felt bad because I really wanted to say, hey, Scott, man, I loved it, thanks for the recommendation. And I was like, oh my god, no. And then I hate wasting anything, but like I tried, I think, 3 cans of it, and I just wasn't like a fan of it. And I'm like, man, this sucks. I even tried it different ways. I tried it like, oh, I mixed it with some regular seltzer water. I put it in ice. You know, I just like, I was trying to make it work. And then I was like, oh man, this is just not great. And then I later, over this past Christmas, you know, I got my wife one of those, you know, the mini Keurigs or whatever for a quick thing. And we're trying out some, you know, I like a chai tea latte or whatever. So I was trying out like one of those cups, and I'm like, I drink it, and I'm like, it starts to taste fine, but then it's like, there's just something weird about the aftertaste, and just not really digging it. And I had a couple days in a row, and wasn't treating my body well. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is going on? And then I looked at the package, and it said sweetened with stevia, and I'm like,
That's the culprit.
And, you know,
it's
some of those artificial sweeteners for me, like the aspartame or whatever in like regular diet Coke or whatever, diet soda stuff, is I've never really had an issue with it, but like sorbitol and like the stevia stuff, like, man, it wreaks havoc with my stomach if I'm not paying attention.
which
sucks because
it's an acquired taste, I think, for sure. Yeah, but then it just, for some people, it just doesn't get acquired. Yeah.
It's good, it's out there for some people, but for me, I was just like, no thanks. So, you know, but it is kind of funny to me now that you bring up my other soda arch nemesis, and that is Dr. Pepper.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as a mature adult, or an attempt to be a mature adult, you know, I can say that it's not necessarily, I think it tastes bad or whatever, but growing up as a kid, I loved root beer. And whenever we would go somewhere and I would ask for root beer, They said, "Oh, I'm sorry, we don't have root beer. We got Dr. Pepper."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Dr. Pepper is not fucking root beer. It is not even the same."
Close. Yeah.
And yeah. I just developed a very, I'm not a super big fan of it, but like, my dislike for Dr. Pepper would definitely became irrational at that point, because it was like almost like a running joke that, even when we went to like, friends, family's houses for parties or whatever, you know, and ask, you know, we'd see what sodas they got, like, "Oh, we got Dr. Pepper." And I'm like, "Fucking Dr. Pepper, Jesus Christ." And it's also a thing like the people, it's funny because the people I know that like love Dr. Pepper, fucking, they love Dr. Pepper. Like that's their jam. It's like a Diet Coke thing with some of these people. And I'm like, I don't get it. I don't see it. I don't get it. But you know what? I'm glad you're drinking something that's not going to put you back in the hospital, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, it may put me back in the hospital, but you know, what am I going to do? Not drink soda? Not an option. So,
Last time you recommended some really interesting music. It was kind of like a drony, staticky type of thing. And at first listen, I was like, I don't know if I can get into this, but I did give it, you know, the good old college try. And I ended up really like liking it. And I haven't gone back to it in a while, but I did go back to it a few times just to kind of have kind of like as a kind of almost like a white or brown noise in my head while I did stuff. And that was you know, recommendation. Yeah, I was like, "All right, all right, this is good stuff. Yeah. This is good stuff."
Yeah.
But how about now? What you've been listening to now?
Man, same sort of zone, noise, drone, you know, pretty much if it has recognizable instruments, I'm not interested in it, you know. a lot of just sound, you know. This new, where is it? Let's see. This is super good. This just got reissued. This is the, there's nothing on the cover, but it's a Skin Crime CD, self-titled. It was a tape that came out in 97. It's just been reissued on CD. And it's real fucking gnarly. So it's, you know, for me, like metal stopped being like heavy enough for me, you know, even like the most aggressive stuff just stopped being heavy enough. And then sort of progressed to listening to basically just straight harsh noise. And that is like, to me, like,
as you get into like heavier and heavier metal and like the more almost like dissonant everything becomes, I see the transition from like, because if you know, you started off from a point, you know, being into that kind of stuff way sooner than, you know, other people, like as you progress as a person or whatever listening to things. Yeah, I totally see the chain through for that. For me, for myself, I'm just, you know, within the early couple years of dipping my toes into death metal and some black metal stuff, you know, whatever they want to call deathcore, whatever it is, man, whatever it is. You know, you know, kind of the opposite of you a little bit, where you're like, if it has discernible instruments, no thanks. For me, like I just, you know, I love a good riff. I love a good drum groove. Yeah. I love some good audible heavy bass. Not bass, but like bass guitar bass.
No, I know. I love all that shit too. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love all that shit too. It's not a focal point of my listening for the past couple years.
This is just for me. Like that's kind of the like I'll forgive a lot if like any one or two of those things is really good album. Sure. I'll forgive a lot still. I see how it progresses and all that. Cause even now, like whenever I'm checking out like a new death metal band or something like that, I'm finding myself like listening and I'm like, this sounds too produced. And I'm like, wait a second. Like, I listen to some of the most produced shit in the world. Like if you listen to like any like modern, again, these are genres that I'm just what people call them, but like symphonic deathcore. Like you have like production elements for like almost like a movie happening and sound effects and things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's great
and
it's awesome. But it's also like I'm also like stepping back, like who the fuck am I? Like it's too produced. Like what are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
But then I'm like, I'm just realizing that like I'm, my ear for that dissonance is growing and that and all that. So, So I'm eager to check out some more things to kind of broaden that horizon a bit more.
Hell yeah.
Oh, cool. If you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, you're not going to see this, but, if you go over to YouTube and you'll see the video version, Scott's got like a killer looking tape collection right behind him of all these cassette tapes and all that. Is that something, is that like a holdover from the old days and stuff like that? Or is it something more recent? Cause I could just because I've known some people. Yeah. Who have gotten to tapes recently.
Most of my tapes are from the past. I would say 6 or 7 years. I purchased most of the tapes. Vinyl's always been like my format since I was a kid. It was always just vinyl, right? And then CD's probably my favorite format now because it's inexpensive, it doesn't take up a lot of space, and it fucking sounds great, right? I like what you can't see is like just CD stacks of CDs just everywhere on the, you know, just stacked up, no order. You know, they're kind of roughly by genre, but that's basically it. But then there's vinyl in front of me. You can't see, there's vinyl everywhere. And then there's, yeah, there's tapes like all over the place. Tape's probably my least favorite format, but a lot of stuff I like is only available on tape. So I kind of just deal with it, you know? But yeah, I have a component stereo here in my office. CD, six disc CD changer, tape deck, turntable, you know, I don't really listen to anything digitally unless it's only available digitally, and I'll maybe check it out. But for the most part, everything I listen to, I buy on physical format, and I try to buy either from the band or from the label. So that's, you know, that's just sort of, you know, try to support, you know, support in that way, you know.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Have you ever like thought about like getting like one of those converters to like move your tapes to at least a digital format just so you can like burn a CD of it?
Well, there's a
if you have the stereo tapes setup. I'm sorry. Yeah,
luckily a lot of new tapes come with digital download, like if you buy it through Bandcamp or buy from label, they'll send you digital download. A lot of times with things that are if it's only released digitally, I'll often buy it digitally and just burn it in CD and then listen to it on CD, you know. Because that sounds, my speakers sound better than my computer speakers, you know, my monitor speakers. Yeah. So you know, I'll do that. But yeah, you know, part of my sort of ritual is that is like every day sort of pulling out what I'm going to listen to for the day, you know. And sometimes I'll go 2 or 3 days with the same sort of little rotation of stuff, especially if it's new stuff and I want to listen everything 3 or 4 times before I shelve it, you know. Like I just got. Yesterday, I just got these Jim Kirkwood CDs. They're reissues of his tapes from the 90s. This is like totally fucking obscure, like dungeon synth before dungeon synth existed, right?
Oh yeah, so I've listened to some dungeon synth before. I really liked it, actually.
Yeah, so most of like the, you can't really see it, but I have like, I probably have 400 dungeon synth tapes and tons of vinyl and CDs. So, nice. I mean, that's another genre I'm interested in. But the Kirkwood stuff, man, is super cool. Like he was just making this shit to like, you know, no audience whatsoever and just making a lot of it, you know, which is super inspiring to me, as somebody who writes comics to almost no audience, you know. It's super inspiring, and then to see it coming out, you know, 30 years later on CD, tape, and vinyl reissues, you know, it's just it's kind of amazing, awesome. You know. But the CDs just they fucking sound great. Out of Season put those out. That's a label out of Maine. And so those have been in the player. Those will probably be in the player for 3 or 4 days before I sort of cycle them out for a little bit, you know. But It's super, super good stuff if you're into any, if you're into like fantasy music at all, right? Like it was all directly inspired by Tolkien, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was just making the music because that was what he was into, and he was sort of making these soundtracks, and they're super good. They're kind of gloomy and dark, but also kind of triumphant. It's amazing stuff. Yeah, really good stuff.
It's I forget who like introduced me to Dungeon Synth. I know it was someone on Twitter. I don't want to misname anybody, but that was definitely something that once you've brought it up again, I'm like, oh man, I haven't listened to any of that in a while. But that was some really good stuff. It's just like you said, it's like it's got this like fantasy aspect, but it's also dark. You know, it's got that forebodingness to it.
The darker stuff is definitely more interesting to me. But there's some really good stuff out there. If you ever want your recommendations, I can send you a list.
100%.
Really good stuff. Yeah.
It's very likely my youngest is going into full-time kindergarten this fall, which means I will be getting like an extra 4+ hours out of my day to work during the day. Yeah. Which also means I'm going to need to have some shit playing in my ears.
That's how it goes, man. As soon as you wake up, turn it on. Don't turn it off till you go to bed, you know?
So I'm definitely going to be hitting you up for some recommendations to get some of that going. Because also, I find I like to listen to certain types of music during certain types of year, almost.
Yeah.
Because I find like... in spring and fall, like I'm really drawn to like synth stuff, either synth wave, pop, synth, you know, dungeons, whatever. And just something about that changing of the season and like the evenings being like cooler than, you know, colder than everything else, but still like fresh almost.
I know what you mean.
Something about that just pairs with that vibe so well. And I'm looking forward to jumping back into some of that. So yeah, I'll definitely hit you that. And also that's Kirkwood stuff. I'm gonna go check that out. Is that on Bandcamp? Did he put the to get the CDs and stuff, or is it just
I just got it from the label. It's like outofseasonlabel.com. Okay. Yeah. It's a sick label. I have like, I don't know, 100 of their releases, you know. They do some really, really good. It's very well curated, right? Like it's one of those labels where it's like, I mean, obviously they put out some things that I didn't like, but like for the most part, it's really well curated, and you're like, you know, 90% success rate. You can blind buy it and you're like, oh, this is sick, you know. So
that's awesome. So you know, what about comics? What comics have you been reading lately that's kind of been inspiring you or just enjoying in general?
Man, what have I been reading? So I'm reading this manga called PTSD Radio. I don't know if you've read it. It's a horror manga. It's very strange. It's long. It's 2 volumes. It's probably 600, 800 pages total. And it's all these like 3-4 page bursts that sometimes tie in together. Doesn't really create a cohesive storyline, but the whole thing's very unsettling. Really interesting. Was recommended to me by Sam Johns, who's a writer on House of Slaughter. They recommended it to me. Good recommendation. Good book. Digging that. I just read the last issue of The Enfield Gang Massacre Tonight, which my buddy Chris Condon is writing, with art by Jake Phillips. Super good. I've been digging that. The new Brubaker Phillips graphic novel, Where the Body Was. Okay. Super good. They're known for their crime stuff, and it's like you read this and it's like not even really crime. It's just sort of a drama, but it's like they work so well together, and their body work is really immense. And, that's super inspirational too. Yeah.
Awesome. So
I don't know, man. I mean, I read comics all the time, but those are three, you know, those are three recent ones that that I dug. I'm sure there's something I would be kicking myself for not remembering, but those are three.
That's how it goes. Yeah.
What's that?
That's how it goes, right? You know.
Yeah, just, yeah. No, the only other thing I was going to mention is manga called Blood on the Tracks. That is like, I think it's about 15 volumes deep at this point. It is like super fucking gloomy, bleak story about this boy and his relationship with his mother. Man, it is so fucking grim and dark and just nothing like it in American comics at all, you know. But really, really moving, beautiful, terrifying work. So I've really been digging that too.
Awesome. Well, you know, you were so kind enough to send over a whole bunch of PDFs of stuff you've been working on, including, you know, Killmore, 3 days, to Death is Here, Left Hand Path, a couple one shots you did with, Death Sky Publishing. And, you know, I loved True Cult, thought it was awesome. You know, I was really happy to see, you know, some of the stuff for, you know, opportunities that came for you after that, like, you know, working on Pennyworth and you know, a few other one shots and other stuff here and there. Is the one shot format something for you that you're still kind of like enamored with? Because it's something I haven't really done yet, and it's something that really intrigues me. Because I've done shorts and I've done longer stories, but like that's it feels like a sweet spot that like maybe you know, that would be really, really fun to explore. So, you know, I have to ask, is it something that's, is there still like a novelty to it for you? I guess novelty kind of trivializes a little bit, but you know what I mean? Is it still exciting?
I know what you're saying. Yeah. I love one shots. I love the format. I think, you know, the there's a couple of reasons. I mean, from an artistic perspective, creative perspective, really forces you to distill the story down and really focus on telling the story in the tightest way possible. Yeah. Right. Because you don't have any room for fooling around. You don't have room for like jokes. I mean, you have room for jokes, but like, you know, you could have 2 pages. If you have a 4-issue miniseries, you can waste 2 pages just for something funny that you want to have happen that doesn't necessarily affect the plot. Right. But in a 22-page one shot, 20-page one shot, 24 pages, whatever, you don't necessarily have that luxury, right? So everything has really got to do a lot of work for you. So from a creative perspective, I really like it. From a practical perspective, I also really like it because it's not a huge commitment. It's a lot easier to get 24 pages out of an artist than 88, right? So. It's a lot easier to, get that amount of work, but it's also easier to convince an artist that this is worth their time to do, right? When it's something shorter, it's not as much of a commitment, right? They can do it between other jobs or a page here and there, and it's eventually done, you know? So I like it from that perspective. From a business perspective, they're fucking great too, because when you're tabling somewhere, right? You know, okay. So at New York Comic Con this year, right? Liana Kengis, who's my co-creator on True Cult, was tabling in Artist Alley, and I basically, after I got all my business for the weekend out of the way, I was free basically on Saturday and Sunday. And I hung out with them at the table, and we sold something like 55 copies of the True Cult trade over the weekend in New York Comic Con. Right. Which is sensational.
Yeah.
Right.
That's like, nuts.
Nobody's going to be mad about selling 55 copies of a single book at New York Comic Con. Right. Or any show. Right.
Yeah. Really.
What I realized is it's fucking easier to sell someone a $20 trade paperback fits the entire story than it is to sell them a $5 issue one of an of something that's unfinished or something where they've got to buy more issues.
Yeah.
So the cool thing about a one shot is that you can sell it for $5 or $6 and it's the whole story. So now you have a lower priced item too, right? Yeah. Maybe they don't want to drop $20 on True Cult or whatever. They don't have $20 or whatever, you know, but you know, $5, this is the whole story.
Yeah.
There you go. From like a business economic perspective, it's really cool that way too. Also a lot easier to get people to read it. Not as much of a commitment. Hey, it's 32 pages, right? You can read it in one sitting and you're good, you know, go, you know, so, there's a lot to be said for them, I think, you know, as a format. And I really like the format a lot. I'm really happy that, Dead Sky picked up the Left-Hand Path because Ken Knudsen, who's the artist on that book, he and I made that book over the course of a couple of years. We were just doing it for ourselves. We didn't really know what we were going to do with it. And I had decided that I was just going to print like 100 copies, just go and print 100 yeah. copies of it for New York Comic Con 2022. And somewhere a couple months before New York Comic Con, I had been talking to Steve at Dead Sky about doing the Western one shot, 3 Days to Death Is Here, that you read. I was talking to him about doing that, and I just mentioned that I had this one shot, you know, and he said he wanted to take a look, and then he was like, we'd like to publish this, you know. So, you know, it sold out. It's great. Didn't have a huge print run, but it sold out, you know, from the distributor. But it got a much bigger audience through them than it would have if I had printed 100 copies to try and sell it New York Comic Con, you know? So I was just super, super grateful, that it was able to come out. I think we're going to do a second printing at some point too. That's the other cool thing about a one shot, right? It's like, you can just reprint it. And it's available to a new audience, right? It's not like a 4-issue miniseries or something where it's like,
yeah, yes.
Oh, well, we reprint number one, but we don't have enough copies of number two, you know, and it's this whole balancing act, right? It's like, oh, we can just print 1,000 more copies or 2,000 more copies or whatever, you know? And I think there's really something to be said for that. And it's a low priced item, you know, it's, I don't know. I love the format. You know, it's, you know, they're a lot of work, you know, I mean, it's all a lot of work. What am I saying? Right. I've written graphic novels. I've written miniseries. I've written whatever, right. Short stories, and you know, two pagers, one pagers, you know, one shots, whatever. Right. I've written all these different lengths, you know, I've written a 300 page graphic novel, right. Like everything, you know, they're all hard, right? They're all difficult, yeah. Right.
So, just some end sooner than others.
Yeah, right. So but it's all about, you know, it's all about sort of pacing, you know, getting the pacing right. You know, for me it always starts with like the pacing, you know, and with such a small number of pages, you really have to sort of figure out. It really forces you to think about what the story is. I think when you do like an ongoing or a mini series, you can kind of wing it maybe a little bit sometimes. You're like, well, I don't quite know what's going to happen in this issue, but let me just start writing and see what happens. You know, you can't do that with a one shot, you know, excuse me, if you've only got a limited number of pages, you really got to figure it out. You know, now I don't typically just wing anything, you know, like I really try to think everything through closely before I start writing, because I think, that's really the way to get the best, you know, the best work. Mm-hmm. Although Liana and I are doing a new book, together, and it's a horror book, and I am for the first time, I'm winging it as I'm writing a little bit. But that's because it has a very, very rigid format. Right. Okay. It's 5 44 page issues, and every page is 4 widescreen panels. Right.
Okay.
So it's very rigid. I'm winging it a little bit because it's kind of it gives a little bit of a sense of mystery for me as I'm writing in a way that I want. It's a horror book, and it's kind of like I don't want to know what's going to happen, right? I want to find out as I'm writing,
yeah.
Right? Versus everything else I ever write, it's like I know the beginning, I know the end, I know the middle, I know the second page, the 34th, like I know every single page what happens yeah. before I start writing, you know, because I sit down and I meticulously, you know, plot it out. And then, you know, after each issue, I replot the rest of the book depending on what has happened, you know, and how I change mm-hmm. things in the issue, you know. So I guess, you know, I meticulously sort of plan everything. And this is one time when I'm not doing that. Because I'm just trying to see if how it changes the story if I do that, you know. So
no, yeah, it's I'm glad you're working in that format. I'm glad you and Liana are working on something else again. I think I am very much in the camp of telling anybody, including myself, that when you know, as a general rule, I think stories come out better when you know what the ending is before you start writing everything. Yeah. And you know, that's not like, oh, there's no good endings that happen without, you know, no, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is for the majority of people, like mm-hmm. how many large pieces of media that like, you know, got like, you know, huge followings or whatever. And then you realize like they had no idea how they're going to end this. And they're just floundering and it loses all its spark and magic.
Yeah.
And right. it's very reminiscent of music to me where that, you know, the, I forget where I picked this up from, but basically, if you're writing a song, right, you typically have like an intro to the song, and a mistake a lot of people make is writing the intro first, because what are you writing an intro to? What are you writing? Right. What are you introducing? Yeah. You don't know. You have no idea.
Right.
You're not done yet.
Exactly. Yep.
So,
exactly.
But to flip it to like where, you know, how you're doing it is also you have enough work under your belt. You've done enough of this. And also you have that rigid format to where like you can improvise, you know, and again, to draw it back to like, you know, music is, people who improvise on stage and stuff like that, they didn't pick up the guitar yesterday. They didn't pick up the drums yesterday. They've been doing this for years. They know what they're doing. So when they fly off the handle a little bit, they have enough experience to know when it's like, all right, I'm going too far. Let me ring it back in. Let me do this. I can't stray too far from here. And I feel like it's very much the same with comics when, you know, because you've done enough. You've worked with Liana before. You guys know each other, you know how they draw, they know how you write. So you have this comfort level. And then again, like you said, it's a very rigid format. So giving yourself that ability to just have that mystery and all that, I think it's a really great idea. And I think, you know, you've definitely shown with your previous work that you've put in the thought, you've put in the time. So I feel like experimenting for yourself in this way is going to be really cool and interesting. And I'm very curious to see how, you know, what the book is when it comes out and, you know, knowing this is kind of how you're working with it. I'm very curious to see, you know, how if it differs at all in terms of like how things felt with your other books, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's definitely a different feel. I mean, I won't say too much, but you know, as we were even doing True Cult, we were talking about, all right, well, what do we want to do next? Like, we knew we wanted to keep working together. What do we want to do mm-hmm. next? And I had three or four things, you know, that I was kind of thinking about. And so we sort of looked at them and, you know, but one of them, I was like, we can't do this one next. This is too much like True Cult. Mm-hmm. I don't want us to get pigeonholed, right? As this is exactly what we do. So, we did something a lot different from True Cult, right? Still be recognizable as the same art team, but definitely a different tone, different feel, different vibe. I always plot it out. I always plot out fairly meticulously. And I have snippets of dialogue as I'm plotting that I think might be good here and there, that may or may not end up getting used. But, you know, I always knew when I could see the first page, and I knew exactly what happens on the first page, and I knew exactly what happened on the last page, no matter how many pages were in between them. But I always knew when I knew those two things, I was ready to start writing, you know? So, that's always been sort of that's always been sort of like the signal that I sort of understand myself is like, okay, all right. Right. So I'm putting something together for a work for hire, just a small work for hire thing. And, you know, I know the first page. So now I've got to just pace around and procrastinate as much as possible. And then at some point, the last page is I'm going to go, oh, now I'm ready. Now I'll figure out what happens in the middle, but now I know the beginning and the end. And now I just have to figure out how to, you know, blow minds in the middle, you know?
Yeah. It's funny to hear you say that, because I think, as a fellow creative and other creatives who may be listening, you know, that's how it works sometimes. Yeah. It looks like you're not doing, it looks like you're procrastinating. It looks like you're not doing anything, but you're kind of, you know, you're kind of almost, charging up.
Yeah.
And then once your meter hits that level, you're like, ah, that's where it is. 'Cause I literally just had that experience. I'm, currently laying out the pages for the next EV in the Helsing's issue. And I was kind of stuck for a couple of days, and not that, you know, the scripts I get from Steve are great. You know, he gives me plenty of like clear intent and direction, but also plenty of rope to hang myself with, you know? So it kind of became this thing like, oh, what am I going to do? And there's this one sequence in there that was kind of throwing me off, and it was a few pages past where I was currently working. But I knew that leading into that page, I wanted to have, you know, I needed to know where I was going, you know?
Yeah.
So when, you know, that finally happened to me this morning, like, I was like, boom, like I laid out those, you know, six or seven pages, like, you know, not necessarily fast, but like,
right,
without like hesitation on anything.
You saw where you were going, yeah, and you could just sit down and then do it.
And then when that happens, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but I hope, you know, I'm hoping it's a feeling we all get. It's like, you just feel like, so like, yes. Okay. You're so excited about what you're doing and what's going down, on the page, that you're just like, you don't want to stop then. that becomes a whole new issue when you got to stop.
I mean, that's a good thing about comics, right? Is there's a you have to stop. Like, there's a place. There's 20 pages. There's 22 pages. You have to stop. You know.
Yeah.
But you know, you can always sort of stretch it out. I mean, I'm writing the ninth issue of Killmore right now, and the ninth, obviously, the last issue of a series. So the 10 will be the last issue. But it's the last issue of a series is always the toughest one. But this ninth issue is one of the toughest things I've ever written. Just every page has to be a banger, you know?
Yeah.
And it's I'm just paralyzed. I was talking to Max Allen Fuchs, who's the artist on the book, and I was talking to him, you know. And I was like, I'm fucking paralyzed, man. I can't write this fucking book. Like, I've written a handful of pages here and there, and I cannot write this fucking issue. You know, and he was basically like, you know, we'll just write something that sucks.
Yeah.
And then you can move on and fix it, you know? And I was like, yeah, I should just write something that sucks. Right. So, 'cause then at least you've got I know what happens on the page, right? Like, I've already, I know what happens on the page, and it's like, I write it and I'm like, man, this is a boring ass page, but like, it doesn't have to be, but it's for now. Now I can move to the next page. Right. And then you can always go back and figure out what are the things that can take the page to, can make it good, or can make it even better, or can take it to the next level, you know? And you know, in that book, especially because we're putting so much into every page, whether it's sort of hidden story things in the art, whether it's allusions to other things we've seen in the book, whether it's actual fucking clues, right, for the fucking detectives that are right there on the page, we're drawing them in, right? But also in the dialogue, the sort of, you know, where we're both, you know, we're telling a story, we're showing a relationship between people, but we also want it to be enjoyable to read and riveting. And, you know, you sort of, there's so many things in every single panel, right? Every single panel is like a fucking fight. But I think, you know, it's worth it, right? But it's could definitely be a struggle to actually, you know, get it to where it's something that you feel good about, because you have such sort of high standards, you know, or at least I do. We do have such high standards for ourselves and for the book, you know.
Well, yeah, and you know, you sent a few issues over of Kilmore, and you know, I read the first couple. It's a really, I love the premise. The art obviously is fantastic. You know, I love the story, and yeah, it's very clear that, you know, you guys are putting your whole ass into this book and everything you're doing. Yeah. You know, you just feel it. You know, because even, you know, Max's artwork is awesome, and he really captures that kind of having a lot of detail, but not being cluttered or not being overly fussy, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it works, and again, it works really well with the story and, you know, this, how everything's weaving in together. And so when you guys are dropping the things here and there, it's right there. You know, you can, you won't miss it, but you could just because, you're not going to bend over backwards to like try to find something or whatever, but you could easily just get lost in everything else and not notice it right away.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, a very delicate thing to do, especially in comics, because, you know, something I love in recent years is there's been a definite pushback against the intense amount of detail required that people were calling for people, like, you know, as much as I love, you know, his work and the stuff he's done, like, but not everyone is Brian Hitch, you know, not everyone is, you know, going to put in all of that stuff, all of that. Yeah. And it's not necessary for everything.
Right.
I think
there's
a great tweet that goes around. I don't know the source of it, but it's basically like, this is why comic artists don't draw a book a month anymore. And it's basically Captain America's boot.
The
little swashbuckler boot. And the other one's this highly detailed, you know, boot with seam lines and stuff and all that. Don't get me wrong. You know, I drew an extremely detailed boot for a cover recently. I love it.
Yeah.
But there's also times where it's like, okay, you know, this, I'm not going to fully render this background person. There's going to be this little thing here, you know, and I'm glad to see that that's becoming, you know, that's not what's being demanded of artists and stuff anymore, because as much as we love telling stories, we also like living and breathing and sleeping.
Yeah. And, right. Well, you know, when we were doing, True Cult, you know, Liana was like, oh, I want to go back. There's some pages. There's a lot of things I want to fix. And I was like what? Cause you know, we'd fix some things as we went or whatever. I was like what, you know? And they were like, well, you know, this car, for instance, you know, can't really tell what kind of car it is or whatever. And I was like, does it have four wheels? Does it have windows? Doors?
It's a fucking car.
Who gives a fuck? It's a car. It's all that matters is that it's a car. The reader will know it's a car. No reason to redraw this, you know? Yeah. So, you know, you can definitely get away with, like, depending on the story, right? I mean, I guess it would be absurd in like a Brian Hitch book if like you couldn't tell it was, whether it was a sedan or a hatchback or something, right? Like, yeah, it would be insane.
You know,
like,
I mean, and that's, book, it that's, doesn't matter. Yeah. That's what he cultivated. That's what, you know, he did for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something I've long said, and I tell, you know, whenever for some reason, some younger artist or something, you know, comes up to my table and asks me for anything, any advice or anything. And that is one to, you know, to really look at original art from your favorite uh-huh. artist that you admire. I mean, uh-huh. and I say, yeah. I say, really look at, I mean, zoom in on the shit that yeah. you don't, that's not the flashy stuff. Yeah. And you're going to find things where like, oh, they didn't do all of that. Or they didn't do this. Or this looks a little scratchy here or whatever. But you don't notice. You don't care. Right?
Yeah.
Because, yeah. you know, my favorite example is I was looking at Cliff Chang pages, you know, uh-huh. and uh-huh. I'm looking at these windows he's doing in the background. And I'm like, oh, he's not drawing every window line. He's not drawing no. every cross. No. And it's like telling myself, like, you're not better than fucking Cliff Chang. You don't have to do that. If he doesn't have to do that, you certainly don't have to, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. you know, who are you trying to impress with yeah. that? So,
I have two pages of Cliff Chang art in my basement and, yeah. I look at them every day. It's amazing.
Yeah. He's one of my favorite artists.
Just incredible.
Yeah. I'm, you know, I have the all the trades of Paper Girls behind me here that I have not, I read the first one and a half and I had to stop. And then, you know, I was picking them up. Cause I'm like, I know I'm going to love this anyway. I'm just going to pick this up.
Yeah, it's great.
But
yeah,
but like Invincible, yeah. like I have not read them yet because I know it's going to end.
Yeah.
I'm just not yeah. ready to have it end yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, I don't know if there's like an equivalent of like that for writers. Is that kind of, is there something like that where it's like, you know, I don't have to, cause I to probably the oh, tie man. It up neater. A lot of the writers I work with, you know, I've always been given for the most part, a lot of leeway in everything, yeah. you know, there's like, yeah. do whatever you want. Like here's a suggestion yeah. for the camera angle. I was thinking right. only on occasion, be like, I really had this in my head, you know,
yeah,
you know, for the most part. And so it is like kind of like letting go some of that stuff. Kind of the same principle for writers, or is it really just a personality thing? Because I don't know if some writers were just like, no, I never really asked for that kind of stuff. I just kind of wanted the artist to do the artist thing, you know?
Definitely a personality thing. I mean, if you look at an Alan Moore script, they're insane. Yeah. And it's insane that there's any artist who would ever want to work with him. That said, he's the greatest writer the medium has ever seen and probably ever will see. And pretty much everything he wrote is a goddamn masterpiece, yeah. you know? So who am I? But if you look at the scripts now, it's the work of an insane person, right? Like it's wild. But yeah, it's a personality thing, I think, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. you have, like, if you look at Alan Moore's massive influence on me, but Brian Azzarello is a writer I really, really admire as well. And, you know, you look at a Brian Azzarello script, there's like 9 words on the page, you know, and an Alan Moore script yeah. has 700 on the page and they're all in all caps or whatever. Right. So it's definitely just everyone is different. And when, you know, and I write differently on my creator own work than I write on my work for hire stuff, right? Work for hire stuff. Mm-hmm. I care less. And I don't mean care less in the sense that I don't try to do a good job. I just mean, I don't own the characters. I don't have as much of a stake in it. Right.
Yeah.
Like, so the way I approach the writing and the relationship with the artist is different. Also work for hire. A lot of times you never even talk to the artist.
Yeah.
You never even talk to them. You know, you're never on the same email chain with them. So mm-hmm. you just see the pages when they're done. Right. Yeah. So a lot of times, you know, with work for hire stuff, I just sort of write it kind of generically in a way that I want it to be clear what I'm envisioning, but I always have a note at the top saying, look, nothing here is set in stone. If you see a way to do something better, go for it. And I'll write mm-hmm. around it. You know, my thing is I will dialogue around something a writer does rather than have them redraw something if it's at all possible. Every now and then there's a legit mistake that affects the story and you're like, mm-hmm. you know, we got to fix this or whatever. But normally if something comes in and I'm like, well, that's totally not what I thought. And you look at the script and you're like, oh, but I see how that's how they read that because I wasn't clear. right? And I go, well, that's my fault. I'll just re-dialogue. I'll make it work, right? So I'll just rework it, you know? So, you know, there's that. And I mean, obviously, like, you know, I write specifically for Liana. I write specifically for Max. I write specifically for Ken, right? The artists, you know, who I work with on Work for Hire stuff the most. I write specifically for them, but I write differently for each one of them, right? Like, because Max is a totally different artist than Liana. So, like, with Max, I have a different approach. Liana has different strengths than Max. So I write to those. I write to those strengths. I'm writing to a different artist, you know. So, you know, it all depends, you know. It's all like a temperament thing, and it's a relationship thing.
No, yeah, it's 100%. And it's I'm glad to hear you talk about how, you know, you change your style up a bit, how you present things based on the artist, because, you know, I don't think people think about this, but at least for me, I know, first, you know, if I'm working with a different writer, I personally get in kind of a different headspace, because I'm thinking about the way they write and the things they like and the things they really like to see, and really trying to, especially now where I'm, you know, bouncing between two different books that are vastly different in terms of how I do things. And, you know, one, I have the Spend the Night book with Jackie Kong, who she's very visual. So she likes a lot of input on the art and the visuals. Yeah. And I don't own that book. I'm Work for Hire on that book, you know, and I've come to like understand that my role in there is much more of a production role, as opposed to, you know, granted, you know, she's given me, you know, times to like, you know, now that we got more comfortable with each other, she's given me times to like spread out my influences on things here. But, but as opposed to like working with Steve on Evie and the Helsings, it's like, basically he's like, just draw your thing that, you know, just, and you know, it's funny because with Steve, like he almost gives me like too few panels. Like I'm always adding panels and things like that for like character beats and stuff. But I also know that that's what Steve and I love, you know, that's what we both like doing. So, you know, I'll be going and adding to stuff like that. But I suppose with Jackie, it's more like, you know, kind of like managing this chaos that she's writing, which in a complimentary way, because the story she writes is just fucking crazy or whatever. So there's all this insane stuff happening. So it's kind of like trying to contain it, as opposed to like trying to expand and stuff like that with the other one. And you know, it also just, you know, the whole, you know, you mentioned like sometimes, you know, people don't even see or know who they're communicate at all with the artist of their book, which, you know, I've long understood as a fact of, you know, publisher books and stuff like that, but it's still so crazy to me that we just don't like,
sucks.
Yeah. And it, not to digress too much, but, but it just reminds me of the story of when, Greg Capullo and Scott Snyder first started working together on Batman and Scott says these hyper detailed, you know, scripts with camera angles noted and stuff like that. And Greg Capullo's like, what the fuck is this? it was intentionally like doing the opposite to piss him off. And then like they got into like an argument before they, I guess they like saw eye to eye, and now they're like best buds. But it's kind of like that thing where it's like,
Greg is a very specific way he wants to work. And on those, that Batman run, you know, he essentially said, we're going to work Marvel style. You're going to give me a plot.
Yeah.
Right. And, Scott had never worked that way. Right. It's tough. Yeah. It's hard, right. Unless you're Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in the '60s or Steve Ditko, it's hard to do. And you really have to, you know, and Pennyworth, the Pennyworth series I wrote was done in a kind of a Marvel style, where, you know, I essentially, because that's how Juan wanted to work, So I would essentially just write a paragraph at the top of the page that said, here's what happens on the page. So maybe like, you know, Alfred climbs a wall and sneaks into the research facility and looks around, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, it's not panel, it's just a thing at the top. And then I would have the dialogue for the page, or what I imagined would be the dialogue page below it. And then obviously, once the art came in, I would then actually map the dialogue to panels and rewrite it to make it fit or whatever, you know. It's a lot more work for the writer that way, you know. And there's a lot more rewriting that happens because the story can take some twists and turns, and you're like, oh, well, I don't even know how to, what this is. I got to figure this out, you know. So, I mean, you know, and the other thing, like, for me is on Kilmore, I'm doing all the color flats on the book, and that's a way for me to like intimately see every single panel in a way that you're just spending, you know, sometimes it takes 5 minutes to do a panel. Sometimes it takes an hour to do a panel, right? Like depending on how detailed it is, but that's a way that you just, really get intimately familiar with every single panel. And for me, that's really helpful because then I start seeing these little things that Max is putting in the book and I can react to that in the scripts. And, you know, so, I think that's something that like, I highly recommend for writers is, well, two things I recommend for writers other than, you know, writing is doing the color flats on a book. Because you really see the art and you have a new appreciation for what you're asking the artist to do. Right. Like, you know, when I first started learning how to do color flats, the first thing I thought was fuck George Perez. Cause all I could think was like, whoever was fucking coloring him must have wanted to fucking hang themselves. Right. Like, it must have been an absolutely brutal job to color him. Right. But as a writer, now that I know I'm the one flatting it, sometimes I'm like, oh, do we need four panels in a crowded police precinct? Because then I think, because he's got to draw it four times, I got to flat it four times, right? So maybe it's, you know, maybe it's something else, you know? So that would be one thing. And the other thing is to learn to letter, not because you're trying to take a job away from a letter or anything, but just because it really helps you understand how to script, and it just helps you understand the hell you put letterers through. So like learning those two things, right? More than anything is a way to understand what your collaborators are doing and what they're going through. And like when you send them a script and you're like, oh, I'm an asshole, right? You're like, oh, I get it now. Okay. Okay, right. Like you it's a real self-awareness moment, you know?
Yeah. I think it's good for any artist and writer across the board to at least once do everything. Do everything. Yeah. Because I just had this conversation a message back and forth with somebody about like, you know, they're like, yeah, I know, I understand, like, you know, artists have, you know, so much more work in the process. And I'm like, yeah, I guess time wise, sure. But like writers deal with so much shit that I would rather not deal with myself, you know? So we both have our creative crosses to bear, you know, it's definitely something where it's like, you know, once you've done it all, cause with my very first book, Pax of Low Country, you know, I lettered the first issue. I have an immense respect for letterers. I like lettering. Absolutely. Lettering is actually very fun. I like doing it. I wouldn't say I'm great at it. I don't think I'm terrible at it, but it's fun. I like it, but it's not, you know, it's not more fun than drawing the book. So, you know, I will always have, unless I need to, I won't do it. Flatting. Yeah. I absolutely despise flatting. I have immense respect for anyone who flats out of, you know, just in general, it is so mind numbing. And I've talked to people who are like, oh, you get into a groove with it and you kind of, it becomes kind of like a meditation. I'm like, not for me, man. Yeah. It is just, it's like, I can feel my skin crawling when I'm doing it. Yeah. It is so,
it's brutal.
And my flats suck. You know, I'm surprised, yeah. If I showed a real flatter my flats, they'd be like, what is this? And like, they've been printing fine. I'm just gonna leave them alone. Coloring, coloring is another thing that, you know, I'm not gonna say I'm great at all. I think I've got a certain like level of competency with it, but in terms of like professional level, like I wouldn't hold the candles to some of these people. You know, the length of time it would take me to like color something. It probably takes me longer to color something than it takes me to draw it. I'll put it that way. Yeah. Like, just because I can
see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
See that because yeah. Then as the artist, now you're trying to use the color to patch over or mask or cover up what you see as shortcomings in the art, right? You're like, oh, well, maybe if this is shadowed more, you know, whatever, like I can add some shadow, I can add a gradient, whatever.
You're still fucking with it. It's like, no, it's a different approach of like, you're finishing it. You're just,
right.
And you know, and also like the way I like to color doesn't always work with the way I like to draw, you know?
Yeah.
And sure. You know, the way I like to color, like I like to use like a lot of like flatter colors and just do like subtle, you know, more subtle things. Yeah. And then like, I like to put a lot of textures over things. Like I have this backlog of like, just like textures I made when I had like all my traditional tools out that I scanned in and stuff. And then, or like old papers and stuff. And I'll put those on things. And I kind of like doing that, but for my particular art style, it doesn't always work. It seems kind of like, so it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, yeah, I can color myself, but it's probably not always the best idea.
Yeah. Honestly, I think with very few exceptions, artists are usually the worst people to color their own work.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and especially since I have, you know, now with the two books I'm on, like I have two very different colorists coloring my work. One is incredibly rendered with lots of details and, you know, adding a lot of shadows and stuff because I don't put as much heavy blacks on the Spend the Night book as I normally would, you know, and it's very rendered and it looks good, you know, but it's also like incredibly different than what, you know, colorist Jason Millay does on Evie and the Helsings, where he colors like almost very subtly, like it's not flat at all, but it's very subtle when he does add like stuff. And then when he does go over rendery or whatever, when he does render more and stuff, you know, he goes for like the vibe, you know?
Yeah.
And there's one image in the first issue where we're first introduced to Evie and the band. And in my head, I'm thinking like, okay, it's this, you know, shot of the band. It's going to be rendered. It's going to have all this, you know, lighting coming down or whatever. Then I get the pages back from Jason and it's just a wash in this like purple and some subtle shadows and stuff and all that. And I fucking loved it. And I'm like, I'm like, oh my God, this is so much better than I would have screwed this up.
Yeah.
Cause he caught the vibe of a band live on stage better than I did when I was thinking about it in my head. So, you know, and that, and again, gives me immense respect for colorists because you can, you know, do something and, you know, it is just like, I saw someone tweet or skeet or whatever it is Blue Sky does. I don't know. I think it was on Blue Sky. But they're basically saying that colorists these days are basically what inkers were in the 80s.
Yeah.
They have that much control over the art.
Yeah.
And I fully agree, you know. Especially with some, you know, some particular art styles where the art is very open. Art is very, you know, there's no indications of shadows or light sources, which is fine, you know, but that art, that colorist is definitely, you know, pulling some weight on there and all that.
Absolutely.
So, and this is just, again, a long way around to saying, if you're going to make comics, try to do everything once. You have a lot more respect and artists. Yeah. Including writing, because
I've done stories. I wrote it, drew it, colored it, lettered it, you know, and it's a very humbling experience for sure.
Yeah. It is. And, but it's also like, you know, I think it's incredibly important just in terms of just getting, you know, not that people are disrespectful as a whole, but like it gives you a better understanding of what you're asking people to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And yep. Fellow artists, when I say write your own book, you know, write something, I don't mean like draw it in layout format, writing it like we like to do.
Right.
I mean, sit down with a blank screen, blank piece of paper and write panel one, page one, do it that way, because you will have like, you'll have so much more appreciation for everything. I won't keep you on too much longer as I yap around, but because my coffee's kicking in and I don't, I feel my second gear's kicking in. But you know, Killmore, you know, you mentioned we can kind of talk about it a bit. It initially came out a little bit from IDW, but now we're changing gears. You guys are getting ready for another release, new publisher and all that. You can't talk about that yet. I get it. But is there, you know, this episode's dropping in roughly a week or so. So it'll be, you know, mid to late January. Is there some news we should be expecting, hearing about when we're going to see more of that or have it, you know, kick back in?
Yeah. So, I mean, nothing, there hasn't been anything online. So, you know, you can do the big reveal here, I guess. But yeah.
I'm sorry.
Killmore's not going to be complete. No, dude, it's all good. Killmore's not going to be, you know, completed through IDW. We're going to finish the book with another publisher, which we're wrapping up the, you know, the negotiations now to just figure out, you know, all the legalese. But yeah, we're super excited that the book is going to come out as intended. Mm-hmm. Which to me is the most important thing, is not ever compromising your vision as an artist, right? Or a writer or whatever you're doing, no fucking compromise, right? Like,
yeah,
the way I see it, you know, my first published comic came out a month before I turned 40, right? So late fucking start, right? And you know, my first creator owned book didn't come out till I was like 45. So fucking late start, right? So the way I see it, I don't know how many as a guy who has a full-time day job, a guy who has a family, you know, and obviously I've got other fucking interests, you know, mm-hmm. but trying to make comics every fucking free second I have, even with that limited amount of time, like I think how many creator owned books am I going to get to do in my career, right? Like, let's say it, and look, any number above zero is fucking lucky, right? So fact that I've got True Cult done under my belt, that I did The Left Hand Path, 3 Days to Death Is Here, and now doing Killmore, doing another book with Liana, you know, maybe another couple things hopefully somewhere down the line, right? Like, you know, thinking about how many I'll have time to do, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's not an unlimited amount. So from my perspective, every single one of them has to be fucking bulletproof, right? Fucking bulletproof. No bullshit. No compromise. Like, this is the work. This is like, sorry, I should just shut the door. You know, this is, mm-hmm. this is my legacy, right? This is what I leave behind, right? Not that I'm planning to die anytime soon, or that I don't mean it to sound like that, but like,
no, I get
this
it.
Is
I get it.
This is what I leave behind. This is going to be the mark I leave. Is going to be these 5 or 6 or 10 or whatever books, right? Because nobody's going to care about the fucking Star Trek story I wrote or this Batman stories I've written. Like, for the most part, nobody's going to give a shit about Pennyworth or fucking Shadow Man or whatever else I've done, right? Like, nobody cares about those. This is what I'll be remembered for, right? And, you know, my thing is I'm not going to fucking compromise for anybody. the book has to come out the way the book is supposed to come out and be what the book is supposed to be, you know? And I think my days of, I think I'm in a lucky position where, you know, when you first start, you know, breaking into comics or trying to get into comics, because you never really break in, you're just constantly trying to stay afloat, you know, and maybe somebody will read your book, you know. But when you first get into comics, or at least for me, you basically say yes to everything that's offered to you, right?
Yeah.
Every job that comes your way, you say yes to. And a lot of those jobs, you're saying yes, even though you know they're fucking dumb, it won't be good, nobody will read it, it won't get you any new fans, it won't get you any new readers, right? But you do it because you love comics and you think, I'm saying yes to a job, it's a comic, this is what I want to do, I have to do this, right? And, you know, I think I'm at the point now where I don't have to say yes to those jobs anymore, right? Like, if something comes my way and somebody's like, you know, I don't know, somebody says, oh man, we're rebooting Madballs, you're the guy to write the fucking book, right? I can say, nah, call a different writer. Give it to somebody else. And they could maybe there's somebody out there who write a fucking amazing Madballs book.
I'm laughing because right? my buddy Ryan Lee, amazing artist, fucking loves Madballs. That would be like a dream.
Yeah, project, right. So there's the thing, right? So there's always going to be somebody who's, there you go, call him, let him do it, you know? And it's not that I look down on the person who's going to write the Madballs book, not at all. Like,
I know what you mean, though.
It's just like a matter, like, because I know, right? Like, you know, like, okay, so like, I don't know, like, I've written Batman, right? And the most fucking, and this is back when Twitter was actually a useful, functional, cool fucking thing. But when the Batman story I did with John Paul Leon was announced, I got something like 200 Twitter followers in a week based on two fucking images that we were posting from the story, right? Which is insane, right? And, you know, I would say approximately zero of those people converted to like fans of mine specifically, right? They were either John Paul Leon fans, they were Batman fans, or they were DC fans or whatever, right? So, you know, you have to have like a long sustained run on a big property or a bunch of properties to build an audience who will come over for your creator owned work, right? But for me, like, I just want to do the creator own stuff, you know? So, you know, I don't know. It's, you know, it's this tough thing where like, we're just begging people to buy our books and you're desperate to find an audience. And I don't know. I just feel like, I know books aren't just like, for the most part, they're not just going to like somehow find some big audience just because they're out there and they're really good. Cause there's plenty of great books that nobody fucking reads, you know? But I think for me, just spending my energy on things I own and that I care deeply about, you know, and what that involves is just not compromising what it is you want to do, you know? So I think that's sort of the fucking vibe for 2024, you know?
Yeah.
Just fucking making sick shit and, you know, you own the book, do what you want, you know?
I'm right there with you. You know, I'm 41, going to be 42 later this year. And, you know, I got a late start, so to speak, in comics, you know? You know, I didn't start drawing again seriously until like I was 30, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, though it's been brought to my attention, it's been 10 years since I started drawing my first real book, Pax of the Low Country. Like in that 10 years, it was just like, I had so many like, you know, changes of like, what does this mean to me? What is this? You know? And right now, I'm on, and I have been for a while, is that, again, I'm 41. I have two kids. I have, you know, responsibilities. You know, I have a family. And though I love a lot of these characters, you know, would I love to draw a Wolverine story or a Star Trek yeah. story or something like that? Sure. That'd be fun.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But if you told me, like, Don, you can draw one of those things, or you can make your own book and have, yeah. you know, maybe not as many people read it, but people are going to read it. Some people are going to enjoy it. I'm going to do that, because mm-hmm. I think yeah, about absolutely. Now is the time I'm spending after everyone's asleep, before everyone's awake during the day. What's more important to me? And I have stories I want to tell. I don't know how many of these stories I'm going to get done. We're never going to, no creative is ever going to get all the work they want done. You know, we're going to die
yeah.
at our typewriters, at our tables, at our studios, you know, figuratively yeah, yeah. Or, you know, literally, or, you know, but so for me, it's like, I need to figure out how to do these, you know? And then, so like Evie and the Helsings, that's a book that, you know, for whenever I'm past or whatever, you know, I want my kids to be able to pick up that book and read it and be like, yeah, this was Dad. You know, yeah, this is Dad's yeah, book, yeah. you know? And some of these one shots I'm thinking of and all these other stories. So I totally feel what you're saying right now. It's just like, you know, and I think that's kind of almost the industry now for a lot of people is like publishing great because you can get some, at least at the very least, you know, not even so much anymore, but there's some sort of like, at least I'll get a little bit of money, maybe get, you know, one or three or four people who will buy my next book just out of curiosity, yeah. maybe.
Right.
But as a whole, it's just people wanting to tell their stories. And I think that's amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kickstarter has been weird lately. Like, I know a lot of people are having issues with Kickstarter and all these other crowdfunders, not because I feel like in the pandemic, like when True Cult came out, it was like, everyone was like kind of like kicking Kickstart into like high gear, you know, single yeah. issue books were, you know, issue ones of books and series were like, it became a viable solution for a lot of people. It came, we're doing that with Evie and the Helsings now, but even now we're talking about like, we have two more issues we have to Kickstart for this volume. Even now we're talking about for the second volume, we might just go straight to trade, you know, yeah. we might just, yeah. you know, and you know, just because it's getting tough out there, and it goes back to the earlier thing you said, having the completed thing.
Yeah.
Here it is. You know, I think in the end, you know, we always wanted to have, you know, Evie and the Helsings be a trade to start off with, but we also, but Steve had kind of developed a kind of how do I put it? Kind of like, He had it down because he was doing single issue stuff with Kickstarter. Right. So he's like, I got this kind of machine going for this. Let's just do this. I'm like, okay, that's fine. And you know, if anything, that made sure. So we did the book as opposed to like endlessly noodling away. But, but to speak to what you said, like it's, to have the finished thing, like feels more, the point than like, let's get it funded. And that's a very lucky privileged stance we can take, Steve and I.
Yeah.
That I know a lot of people can't. A lot of people have to do Kickstarters and stuff to get money to be paid to pay their bills and do these things, you know. And you know, my art income isn't as necessary as that. though in the way this world is going, it's becoming more and more necessary with things. But anyway, to circle back, I'm glad you have that mentality because one, I really enjoy your books. I really enjoy the stories you're writing, and I just want more of them. So I respect and appreciate your stance for yourself. You know, it's your stories, you're taking control. You want to do them the way you want to do them, get them out the way you want them. And that's awesome. And, you know, I think it's definitely something that, you know, I hope a lot of people take to heart. For themselves, And you know, I think it kind of that's kind of the feeling that's going on, because there's been too many of these small publishers going belly up, and then people's books getting tied up in like weird legal things because of it. And yeah, I think we need to take it back and all that. So
Yeah, that's the thing. It's all about control and ownership and making sure that it's, you know, that it isn't caught up in something like that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, before I start, going off into another tangent somewhere else, Scott, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It was a blast
Dude,
talking to you.
thank
I'm looking
you.
forward
Thanks for
to
having
getting
me,
some
for sure.
Dungeon Synth recommendations for you. I'm looking forward to reading, the rest of Killmore when it comes out. And now is the time to let everybody know where they can find you on social media.
Yeah, Instagram is probably the best place. Scott.Brian.Wilson, which is my new account after Instagram deleted my old one with no fucking explanation. Fuck Instagram. I'm also on X, Twitter, fucking bullshit, but I never use it. It's fucking worthless now. But
It
I'm on
is.
there. It's Scott BR Wilson. Totally worthless now. Absolutely worthless. And then I'm on Blue Sky. Scott, I think it's Scott Brian Wilson at dot B Sky or dot social or whatever. Anyway, you type my name, I'm on there.
And I'll make sure there's links to all that in the show notes below. And if things develop with Kilmore and all that, I'll make sure to share those as well. Scott,
Interesting.
again, thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, buddy. Talk to you soon.
Yeah.